Hey, welcome along. We're live around the planet, and it is 4 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. That is 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 10 p.m. in Europe, 11 p.m. in the sands of Egypt, if you're going past the cataracts, and Israel too, midnight in Araby, the wee small hours for our listeners in India. I'm sorry about that. Marginally less uncivilized hour of the day in Oz. Is it Australia Day yet? It's coming up on Friday, and it may already be Friday in Australia. Whatever time it is where you are, we are taking your questions live for Around the Planet. I'm getting some kind of delayed howl round here. Don't know what's going on. Anyway, I don't know. It was all a lot easier in 1978 when we had faders and LP players in the studio. We're taking your questions live, and I'm happy to answer those questions. Let's go with one from Bart Nielsen. Bart says, "Mark, one of the great frustrations in discussing immigration, both European and American, with the open border crowd is the knee-jerk white supremacist racist hater shrieking. Perhaps a little bit less rambunctious than Kyle Lawrence's letter." Kyle Lawrence is some friendly correspondent you may have seen at the website. I think he's offered to behead me on the internet, which is actually we're going to do as pay-per-view. A little bit less rambunctious, most people are, than Kyle, but no different in sentiment. "I'm wondering how we get our interlocutors to move past their visceral hater defense to discuss facts and logic." They don't want to discuss facts and logic, Bart. And the purpose of saying that everyone who wants to talk about this stuff is a racist or a white supremacist is basically to make it to cow you into not raising the subject at all. Tucker Carlson and I last night on Fox News were talking about this very thing, because over at MSNBC, they say that we are white supremacists for wanting to talk about immigration. And what's fascinating is they're the people who talk about race all the time. I mentioned that on election night, Kirsten Powers, who's a Democrat, talked about how Mitt Romney had lost because of the Browning of America, and how Bob Beckel had said that Romney didn't win as big a share of the white vote. And Joy Reid herself at MSNBC is saying it's a waste of time going over after white rural voters. You need to maximize the black vote. So we're now like Zimbabwe, you know, where basically Robert Mugabe has the Shona vote and Joshua Nkomo gets the Ndebele vote. And we've got tribal voting. And that's how they talk about it all the time. Brown vote, black voters, white vote. They're allowed to talk about it all the time. But if you ever want to talk about it, you're a racist. And immigration is public policy. And the reason people, the best way to respond to a leftist who calls you a racist. I mean, there are racists and there are people who talk about race all the time. But racist as an accusation is used by the left to say, don't talk about this. We'll destroy you. We'll hang that racist tag around your neck and you'll never work again. And the best way to neutralize that, I think, is either to ignore it or to acknowledge that they're calling you it, as Tucker and I did. And then move on to demand the right to talk about public policy. Because if you're cowed by the racist thing, then what will happen is you'll lose your country. I mean, that's really the lesson of the last 50 years in the United Kingdom, is that if you make this tag stick, and in Europe, in the wider sense too, is that if you make this, and in Canada, and in Australia, that if you let this happen to the degree it has happened in, say, Sweden, you will lose your country. Deborah Milligan says, "Mr. Stein, here's a go at my question. Haven't seen or heard a Sunday poem in a while. In keeping with the dream of the medieval wall, perhaps you could read some medieval poetry. Not from America, of course, since that continent was yet to be invaded by white supremacists from the Iberian Peninsula, but maybe one of the sirs, Thomas More, Walter Raleigh, Thomas White. We do have a new Sunday poem for you that I'm going to be doing in about a week's time. And actually, we're rather poem heavy in February. I think by the time we get to the end of the month, you'll have had four poems, which may be more poems than anybody wants. Toby Pilling writes, Professor Jordan Peterson, who was on the Mark Steyn Show a few months ago, was recently interviewed in the UK on Channel 4. The virtue-signalling journalist managed to humiliate herself by deliberately and continuously misrepresenting what the professor was saying. His rebuttals, using precise language, have trended over here, leading to Channel 4 claiming victimhood when their journalist began getting lambasted for idiocy. Are there any lessons for us all here regarding getting the message across? Well, it was a fascinating interview, because the interviewer was not interviewing Jordan Peterson in good faith. And all of us who incline to the Jordan Peterson view of the world know that when you're asked on the BBC or the CBC in Canada or whatever, that it's a trap, that they haven't invited you on to engage with your position sincerely. They've invited you on for a bit of sport to make you look like a chump and make you look like a fool. And in fact, the Channel 4 press office thought they'd succeeded in doing that to Jordan Peterson. They thought the interview, I think the lady's name is Kathy Newman. I'm not familiar with that. I used to quote, unquote, for Channel 4 News in the sense that I used to be on a news show on Channel 4 many, many years ago with Dermot Murnaghan. But I don't know who's doing all these shows there now. Kathy Newman, I gather, is her name, something like that. And her response to every question was, so what you're really saying is, and that's not a good faith response, because what the interviewer is doing is, unfortunately, the answer you've given doesn't make you look racist or Islamophobic or sexist or transphobic enough. So I'm going to use a form of words that suits my needs better than your actual answer does. And that was the way she conducted the interview. And the smug twerps at the Channel 4 press office thought it was all going swimmingly and put out sort of gloating tweets. Then when they realised it had been a disaster and Jordan Peterson had actually calmly and politely won that round, they attempted to claim the victim card. They basically said that their poor interviewer was now on the receiving end of death threats. The ones I saw, the Daily Mail, I think, reprinted them. They looked like very lame compared to, say, Kyle Lawrence or the fella who the Palm Beach Police Department were obliged to get in contact with, who was threatening to behead members of my family. I mean, these were in the course of, if you go on the internet, by the standards of things, if these barely qualify as death threats, they're certainly the lamest death threats. Essentially, they were annoyed because she lost, so they wanted to turn her into the victim. And Douglas Murray in The Spectator has a very good piece on this, on the differences in who you're allowed to be mean to on social media. You can't be mean to this Channel 4 journalist, but Katie Hopkins, for example, who many of you know, she appears on Tucker Carlson's show. I met her down in Florida a couple of months back. She's paid a real price for speaking out on the Islamization of her country. And she got sued and was obliged to sell her family home the other day. She has three children. They're now homeless, or they're living in some rented accommodation somewhere. One of the children, I gather, is autistic, according from Douglas's piece. So you'd think this would be like, she's lost her home and her three children are homeless and all this kind of thing. No, not at all, because Katie Hopkins holds incorrect views. You can gloat about her as losing her home as much as you want on Twitter and Facebook. And it is interesting to me that nobody objects at Channel 4 when everybody is gloating over Katie Hopkins' children being homeless on Twitter. The meanness, the victimhood mantle is entirely according to whose politics you espouse. This lady took on Jordan Peterson. He bested her. She lost. Better luck next time. But the idea that she's a victim of anything is complete nonsense. I'm in favour of better behaviour on social media, and it's always very healthy to stay off Twitter for a few days at a time. Just don't go near the thing, lest you be driven to suicide, like a poor compatriot of mine was, a lady, I think she was from the Maritime Provinces, in Canada, who moved to Hollywood and became a pornographic actress, living the American dream, sent out a tweet saying she didn't like to work in porn with gay actors for health reasons. And the gay community was so vicious in its response that she committed suicide within 24 hours. The madness of social media is a phenomenon of our times. Twitter and Facebook. Twitter has become mildly successful by driving people to kill themselves. Facebook has become one of the biggest businesses on the planet by live streaming murder for millions of people to watch. So the idea that we should let those set the standards of public decency, I think, is completely preposterous. But the Channel 4 reporter needs to man up and she staged a big gotcha hit job thing and it didn't work out. And that's all. Lee from Alberta says, I had a good laugh during your last Q&A mop-up when you said it's only a matter of time until some American judge declares the Constitution to be unconstitutional. As funny as it was, it led me to contemplate some what-ifs. What if Canadians, bordering on inconceivable, I know, elect a government committed to prioritizing immigrants from culturally compatible backgrounds, i.e. the Commonwealth, the US, and Europe? What if, following the all-too-predictable outcry from the likes of the CBC and Toronto Star, some living tree jurist or juris declares the policy to be in contravention of the Charter of Rights? If citizens can't have the final say in who joins them, how tenable is their democracy? What is their ultimate recourse? That's a very interesting question, because, as you say, it's a fundamental thing. A nation state is a group of people agreeing to organize themselves on that basis. And it's a bit like the Mark Stein Club writ large. The definition of that nation state is citizenship. If you are a citizen of that nation, then you are the ones who determine the fundamental precepts of the nation, and most especially and most fundamentally, who gets to join you in the club. There is no right to immigration. The people who have the right to live in Slovenia are Slovenes, and if anyone who's non-Slovene wants to join them, it is at the invitation of the existing group of Slovenes. That's how we used to think. Now we don't think like that, and now we think that every Western nation should basically be opening itself up to the rest of the world. That will destroy the West, and it will mean that, people understand that, and they say, fortunately, I won't live to see it. Unless you're, 108 years old and in the late stages of the Ebola virus, you will live to see it, because it's happening very fast. I think at a certain point we need to have a showdown. This whole idea of judges as supreme arbiters, incidentally, is totally repugnant to me. I think it started in the United States, and I think the United States has it because they threw off a king. And when they threw off a king, they realized that a king in a constitutional monarchy fulfills a certain function. You have a constitutional monarchy is a kind of managed democracy. A republic is to a certain extent, a slightly less managed democracy and in many ways a more responsive democracy. But at the same time, you need some precepts, some basic law, according to which the micro laws, the flotsam and jetsam of legislation, have to pass muster by. What we have had instead now is in America, as often joke, the things have become completely reversed. Whenever you hear anything about the legislative branch, it's not legislating, it's holding an investigation into why the FBI isn't coughing up Peter Strzok's text to his paramour. I mean, they're like a quasi-courtroom now. Whenever you see Trey Gowdy on the news in America, he's basically there as a quasi-judge demanding to know why the party of the first part hasn't produced Peter Strzok's texts. And at the same time, judges now are micro-legislating. So district judges are ruling on whether this particular version of Trump's so-called Muslim ban passes muster. At some point, I think you have to have parliaments that are willing to stand up to the overreach of these courts. And it's very important. I mean, actually, Australia is a very good example of this. I've written about this stupid interpretation of Australia's constitution regarding who can sit in parliament that the Australian High Court has done, in which they basically have said if you happen to have a Welsh great uncle and you never knew about him, you're ineligible to sit in the Australian parliament. The problem for me with that is that the law, it seemed to me, as written in the Australian Constitution, its plain meaning was the same for a century. And then in whatever it was, 15 years ago, the Australian High Court changed the meaning. And that's not right. You can only change the Constitution by popular ballot in Australia. And instead, the Australian High Court used up that role and they shouldn't have done. I'm not impressed. You know, it's one thing to throw off George III and say we don't need a guy in red robes and ermine. It's quite another thing to throw off the guy in red robes and ermine and replace him with guys in black robes, which is the thing America. Mark Ferrigno of Peyton, Colorado says, Mark, care to chance a prediction for the 2018 midterms? I know you may be a bit wary to offer a prediction, but are we in for a 2016 repeat regarding polls showing a blue wave? I think you mean a 2006 repeat there, showing a blue wave. I don't think there is going to be a blue wave. Normally in the midterms, the party that holds the White House loses seats. 2002 was a big exception to that rule. I don't think there is going to be a blue wave. I think wave elections are much... I don't think there is going to be a blue wave. I think Democrats have got a very steep hill to climb in the Senate, and I do not think they will take the House. So you can take that to the bank. Chris Hall writes, Mark, you received much criticism for your remarks on the Tucker Carlson show about immigration. One supposedly conservative site accused you of racism and not wanting to have brown people in the US. I heard your remarks on Tucker's show, and it is clear that you were very much misunderstood. Will you take the opportunity to clarify? I understand if you mumble, given the number of words stuffed into your mouth by your critics. No, I don't want to clarify, actually, Chris. I'll tell you why, because I said what I said, and I and the words mean what they said. And it is distressing to me that people do not want to argue in good faith. But if they don't want to argue in good faith, don't bother getting into a debate with them. I'll give you a good example. I was talking about Chris Cuomo, who said he didn't like the demonization of illegal immigrants and started going on about white supremacists. And I said white supremacists are irrelevant. They're American citizens, so you're stuck with them, which plainly means, you know, that then they've got nothing to do with an immigration debate. You don't, when you're having a debate about immigrants, you're talking about foreigners. When you're talking about immigration, there's two kinds of immigration. There's illegal immigration and legal immigration. But both of them involve foreigners. Both of them involve people who aren't here, who are not American. So you can have an immigration debate where you talk about whether you want lots of low-skilled people from Latin America, or whether you want high-tech software engineers from India, or whether you want businessmen from Germany, because Germans, Indians, Latin Americans are all foreigners. White supremacists of the kind Chris Cuomo worries about are nothing to do with the immigration debate because they're US citizens, so they're already here, so you're stuck with them. Now, I noticed that like 1,000 retweets for you know, Mark Stein, quote, Mark Stein, colon, at least, quote, white supremacists are US citizens, unquote. Now, I didn't say at least. That's some little twerp at some, you know, website somewhere putting those words in my mouth. I didn't say that. So why get into an argument with someone who isn't arguing in good faith? Now, you mention, Chris, that some so-called conservative websites decided I was going on about brown people. I didn't mention brown people. And usually when I talk about immigration, usually when I talk about demographics, I try to actually confine it to one skin color so people understand it. Whenever I talk about Turkish demographics, I talk about Ruthenian Turkey and Anatolian Turkey, two types of Turks. So no non-Turks need be involved. And you can see the demographic crisis for Turkey just within Turks. As it happens, you know, if you recall the stupidity over the Boston Marathon when everybody was saying, oh, it was a Caucasian who'd done it. They didn't want to, all these crazy Islamophobes think it's a Muslim. It's far more likely to be a white person. As it happens, it was a couple of Caucasians. They were from the Caucasus. They were Chechens or Dagestanis or whatever the sign. I think the Sarnaevs are Dagestanis from Chechnya. So they're actually Caucasian. We see a stupid thing now where Penelope Cruz, who is a Spanish actress, she's what we used to call, until Americans invented these absurd neo-apartheid categories, Penelope Cruz is what we used to call a Spaniard, which is to say a white person. I think the first time I went to Spain, I was 6 years old. They're not brown people. They're exactly the same color as me. They're Spaniards. They're white Europeans. And then America invented a pseudo-racial category called Hispanic, which can actually be white people and non-white people. So it's like an even nuttier category. And then they started making people who are actually just white Europeans, like Penelope Cruz. Oh, isn't it good? Oh, it's so heartwarming that Hispanics are getting Oscar nominations, because here's this, you know. So on the one hand, some Spaniards, like Christopher Columbus, are white racists who wrecked the continent. But other white Europeans, like Penelope Cruz, those kind of Spaniards are now the racial minority that Christopher Columbus is oppressing. It's all rubbish. It's complete bollocks on stilts, stalking the land from one end to the next. And what was depressing to me about going on Tucker was how many Orwell used to talk about the pansy left. Well, there's a pansy right too. There's a pansy right that thinks that playing on your opponent's terms is all going to work for you. I'm not into apartheid. I'm not into categorizing people by phony baloney groups, which is the way the United States government does it. You know, what's interesting to me is that multiculturalists, this is part of the war on language, multiculturalists are not in the least bit multiculturalist. Their basic premise is everyone's the same. So that immigration, it's racist to distinguish between, say, a Danish feminist and a Sudanese clitoridectomy practitioner. They're all the same. So in fact, what we mean by multiculturalism is uniculturalism. We can't be buggered to find out the differences between you guys in all the rest of the planet, so we're just going to pretend you're all the same, and that's a lot easier for us, and we can all go back to watching television, and we don't have to worry about it. And it's nonsense, and it was particularly pathetic to see so-called conservative websites. And I have a low opinion for Conservatism, Inc. The United States. I think it's enriched a few people, but by and large, most of these so-called... I don't think it's done anything for conservatism, and I think that's one reason why it was so easy for Donald Trump to come along and basically hijack the Republican Party for his own purposes, is because Conservative Inc., but they always play defense. And that guy who was misrepresenting me, that Chris Hall quotes, is a very good example of that. T.F. Boggs writes, got any blowback for your appearance in Can't We Talk About This? Sorry, stupid me, any new type of blowback? Have you had to go full Robert Spencer or Pamela Geller security detail? Look, the thing about this is, Can't We Talk About This, in case you haven't seen it, is this documentary I was interviewed for, along with Pamela Geller, she's on there, Robert Spencer, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, my friend Douglas Murray. I mean, the usual crowd, you know who we are, because basically there's not a lot of us who want to talk about that particular subject in public. The title comes from the last words of Theo van Gogh, who made a film on this subject with Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and a Mohammedan fanatic attacked him in the street, killed him, and the last words of his life before this savage drove the knives through his chest with a note pinned to the knives, promising to do the same to Ayaan Hirsi Ali. The last thing Theo van Gogh said to the savage who killed him was, can't we talk about this? No, you can't talk about it. And that's what the left and the Islamic supremacists have in common. They don't want to have a debate. And the left's way of shutting down the debate is to say, racist! You can't say that. That's their way of debating, just labeling you. Once they pin the label to you, they don't pin the label to you the way this nutter did by driving a knife through your chest with the label pinned to it that way. They just like pin it to you on MSNBC or whatever. Racist, you can't talk about it. And that's what they have in common. That's why people who people don't understand that what are apparent contradictions. For example, the left is super pro-gay, whereas Islam likes to toss gays off the roofs of building or burn them to death. They don't realize that matters less than that both forces are very comfortable with saying, this is the official line and you can't depart from it. So that film, Can't We Talk About This? I think that's an excellent title for it. I think Theo van Gogh's last words, the words of a dying man as he lay in the streets of the supposedly most tolerant city in Europe, and this fanatic killed him. Can't we talk about this? That is the great question for our time, and there's going to be less and less and less that we get to talk about. Mike writes, is it just me, or is the DNC Fusion Steel FBI scandal not 10 times as bad as Watergate? The aims were the same. Go get some dirt on the other guy or their strategy in order to help ensure an election outcome. But whereas Nixon's committee to re-elect the president simply hired some private campaign henchmen like Liddy et al. To break into a hotel room, the Democrats used the institutions of government itself to perform surveillance, not just members of their campaign. Mike, that is a brilliant way of putting it. You know, when the Nixon campaign wanted to engage in dirty tricks, as you point out, they had to go and hire outsiders. They had to pull their hat over their brow and go to the scummy, sleazy part of town and find scummy, sleazy guys who were willing to do that. The Democrats, when they decided to do a bunch of dirty tricks, went, as you say, to the most powerful agencies in the most powerful government in the world. And the institutional corruption of the FBI and the Department of Justice at the highest level is not 10 times as bad as Watergate, but 100 times as Watergate. Because it's not just like scummy, no-name people you recruit on a rotting wharf, down in the sleazy part of town. They're people sitting in the most comfortably upholstered offices in Washington, plotting how to sabotage the incoming president. And the contempt that I mention this all the time, and people, there's a kind of old-fashioned conservative who believes in a certain deference to law and order. And so I always get pushback on this, this law about lying to the FBI. And I say, why shouldn't you lie to the FBI? The FBI lies to us all the time. So Mike Flynn and this Papadopoulos guy, who's a nobody, he's just like a nothing guy. He's a little guy whose life is about to be ruined because he misstated something to the FBI. And so he's got a choice between singing like a canary or going to jail for 30 years. And that's actually, that's dirty and disgusting. That would be dirty and contemptible and not worthy of your support, even if the FBI were the cleanest institution on the planet. But the FBI has just informed us that the texts between Peter Strzok, 5 months of texts between Peter Strzok and his paramour, as she's called, Lisa. The paramour's called Lisa, but everyone refers to her as the paramour. She's the paramour in chief. It's like an official government position now in the FBI. So between Peter Strzok and his paramour, these 5 months of texts, mysteriously, they lost all the texts until the day Robert Mueller was appointed. The day after his appointment, I think it's May the 18th last year, mysteriously, they found the texts again. So, you know, they're basically just openly contemptuous of the United States Congress and of the American people. We know, you know, we're asked, you're supposedly asked to believe, if you're in a lawsuit, as some of us are from time to time, and the opposing party claims to have lost its texts in so they're not available for discovery, you're supposed to just sort of accept that and not infer anything from it. But we're dealing here with the most powerful law enforcement agency on earth. They're the ones who can get you. They know what text you wrote on May the 16th, but they do not know what text Peter Strzok sent to his paramour on May the 16th. This is naked contempt, and it's naked contempt not from peripheral government agencies. I wrote about BLM, not Black Lives Matter, but the Bureau of Land Management, which is a big bloated paramilitary bureaucracy. But it's fair to say that if you, unless you live in certain states and do engage in certain activities, you can lead a life blessedly free of collision with the Bureau of Land Management. When you have a corrupt Department of Justice and you have a corrupt Internal Revenue Service, then I think that is a lot more serious. They're core functions of government. And if you have corrupt tax collectors and a corrupt Justice Department, that's sick. And that's the swamp. And that's the swamp that needs draining. Nicholas Strathy writes, Mr. Lawrence, this is a reference to Kyle Lawrence, who wants to behead me live on the internet. Mr. Lawrence, although finding himself living in the most advanced civilization in history, somehow appears not to have grasped one of its fundamental tenets. Newsflash, the right of free speech means even people I disagree with get to speak. Nicholas, I would like to believe that that was a widely held belief, but I don't think it is anymore. And I think one of the lessons I learned during my troubles up north is that actually not a lot of people will go to the mat for free speech. That in fact, the people like the idea of the apocryphal Voltaire line that I disagree with what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. No, and nobody ever asks you to defend something you don't like to the death. We're just asking, you know, we're not even asking for a mildly supportive tweet. We're just asking for you not to want to shut down anybody who disagrees with you. And 10 years ago, when I was in the midst of my battles in Canada, there was not a mass movement in favor of free speech. And things have got a lot worse since then. And I would say that almost everybody who emerges from an American and most Western universities now emerges with the understanding that, in effect, identity politics has completely trumped free speech. So that free speech, for example, takes a subordinate position to the correct attitude to the transgendered movement. So the reason people get annoyed about transgendered pronouns is because if a guy has decided to identify as a woman and you call him he, it's distressing to him and he's upset about it. She's upset about it. See, I've just done it right there. It's distressing. And the fact that they are distressed and upset trumps free speech. So misgendering someone, as they call it, they beat you. They'll club you to a pulp on Twitter. The correct attitude to gay marriage. The correct attitude to Muslims. And the problem is because we have created a world of different identity groups, and those identity groups, in a sense, are allowed to define themselves, not just for themselves, but for the broader society. So that, for example, if it's illegal in your religion to draw Muhammad, then it's illegal for anybody in any religion to draw Muhammad. Identity politics trumps free speech. And we have raised a generation of people who will who simply don't grasp free speech. They say, well, what do you mean free speech? How can it be right to call her him? It can't be. It can't be. So we have to destroy the person who's using the wrong pronoun. We have to destroy the person who doesn't want to have to bake the cake for the gay wedding. We have to destroy the person who draws the Muhammad cartoon. I don't even, you know, a lot of those things I don't even care about. I'm a kind of fairly live and let live guy, but that's the last thing anybody wants to do. Can't we, again, it comes back to it, can't we talk about it? No, you can't. No, you can't. That's their big message. And that's Patty Villanova says she's been bugging me for some time about the Mann versus Stein case. Why are your lawyers not forcing the issue and using the tools at their disposal to force this case along? There are motions and other devices that can be used to compel a judge to render a decision. Yet your case is just sitting there. It isn't actually sitting there. What's happened is it was procedurally bollocksed by a totally incompetent judge, trial judge, a landlord and tenant judge from the DC Superior Court called Natalia Combs Green. And she wasn't really engaged in the case. And she, to the point where she confused me and one of the other parties in one of her idiotic rulings. She couldn't even get the parties right. I mean, wasn't an engaged judge. And so when it got more complicated, so that people were doing, as Patty suggests, filing motions, she didn't really want to read 200-page motions, which is what they do in the District of Columbia. And And so she retired from the case and passed it on to another judge. But they then came to a mysterious arrangement whereby judge two was ruling on certain matters after whatever it was, October the 3rd, but judge one was still ruling on other matters, you know. So you had two trial judges, ruling on the same case. That would be a big no-no anywhere else in the common law tradition. And it ought to be a big no-no because it's complete rubbish. And so what happened was the case got procedurally bollocks, then was became the subject of an interlocutory appeal. And if you don't know what an interlocutory appeal is, fall on your knees and thank the Lord that you have never had any occasion to find out what an interlocutory appeal was. And in this case, it was an interlocutory appeal to discover whether the new DC slap law was, in fact, interlocutory appealable. So it was an interlocutory appeal to determine whether the law was interlocutory. It was an interlocutory appeal to determine whether the interlocutory appeal was interlocutory appealable. That's how it goes in the District of Columbia. I'd rather take my chances in Kim Jong-un's courtroom because it'd be a hell of a lot quicker. Then that particular appellate court had three judges. And those three judges, one of whom takes 2 years to issue a ruling, right? 2 years. So in this case, she took even longer than this. So it was almost 3 years. She ruled on the interlocutory appeal, and then somebody asked for an en banc review by the full appeals court, which is 7 judges, 9 judges, I don't know, and they're going to be another, but it also still includes the original judge who takes at least 2 years to do an appeal, even on a case she's already ruled on, so there's going to be another 2 years for that, and then it's going to the Supreme Court. So you can't actually force anything here, Patty. I take your point. You can't force anything. All you can do is express your utter contempt for the system. As I always say, in 1900, Chogosh assassinated William McKinley in September, I believe. And by the end of October, they'd fried the guy. And I don't know what he did to get the express check-in, but I would far prefer that to the hell of the DC Superior Court. Thank you for that. Hi, Mark. Do you think the Me Too movement has become a liberal self goal? Says Raj of Ontario, Canada. Well, I do enjoy it. Like, who was it? Scarlett Johansson, who was attacking James Franco at the formerly Pink Pussy Hat March the other day. I mean. You know, I don't have a dog in that fight, I'm happy just to sit back and watch Scarlett Johansson beat up on James Franco. I don't know, we always think these things won't work for them, because in a sense they're so ridiculous. You know, basically, so you had that thing at the Golden Globes where all the women were told that you have to wear black to show that you take the Hollywood's ill-treatment of women seriously. How did Hollywood ill-treat women? Basically, guys like Harvey Weinstein said, you got to do this if you want to get the job. This is what you got to do if you want to get the job. So now Harvey Weinstein and his bathrobe are all exposed, and Hollywood say, oh, yeah, we treat women terribly. Oh, by the way, all you women, you got to wear a black dress to the Golden Globes. Yeah, I don't care what you are planning to wear the little red number. You got to wear the black dress if you want to get a job. I would have given anything to see some contrarian actress turn up in some great rainbow coat of many colors. Just to say, the point about this is we women aren't going to be told what to do by Hollywood big shots instead of meekly climbing into the little black number, that Audrey Hepburn wore in Breakfast at Tiffany's and all looking the same. You know, if you want women in black all looking the same, go to the Waziristani movie awards night. They're all like that. You can't tell the difference between all the women in black and the curtain at the back of the stage. They all blend in. They all look the same. So it was self-evidently ridiculous, Raj. And yet, liberals take it seriously. And they're now doing, they did it seriously at the SAG Awards, where all the presenters are women. Oh, that's great, isn't it? Oh, that's so nice. You know, I think there's a reason why most of it's going on in liberal institutions, not just Hollywood, but PBS and NPR. And I think, in fact, it's a sadder world. I think women are more confused there. I think women are confused about what's expected of them. I mean, how could it be? Charlie Rose is the most civilized sophisticated and acclaimed man in public television. So if he's calling me into a meeting and he's sitting there stark naked with his 75-year-old penis staring at me all meeting long, then it must be, he can't be doing anything wrong. He's Charlie Rose. And I think in a certain sense, liberal institutions make it easier to pull a fast one on impressionable young women. I'll leave it at that, because that's something that... Joseph Dornish says, could you describe a bit of your history? How did you become so literate? You seem to know every book, play, movie, etc. Well, I'm not in the... I'm unlettered. I'm totally unlettered. There was a while when people were called the unlettered Mark Stein. I think the climate guys still call me that, the unlettered Mark. I don't have any letters after my name. It's just Mark Stein, it ends. That's it. There's no letters. There's no BA. There's no BSc. There's no MA. There's no PhD. There's no nothing there. Because in the old days, the idea was to educate you, not wait till you're like in your mid-20s before teaching you stuff, but to actually teach you stuff when you started in kindergarten, grade one, and all the rest of it. So this idea that... that you're unlettered unless you've gone and done colonialism and transgender studies and gotten a master's in it, I think is actually one of the structural deformities of society. Generally speaking, if you don't have a curiosity about certain things by 13 or so, you're never going to. So if you're not into it by the time you're 13, there's not really a lot of point in keeping you in school until you're 33. You can stay in school till 28th grade, but it's generally, you're just killing time, as most of these people are. I make an exception for real disciplines, which I think, you know, there are serious academic disciplines, there are serious fields of scholarship that one can study at a high level. But if it's not one of those, then you're just wasting time, sitting in universities until you're 33. We used to read serious books at school. We used to do serious poetry, and we used to study serious music. And in all those fields, I think it's very, I mean, I think it's particularly bad with classical music, because I think if you don't actually give a child a taste for it as a child, it's really difficult to pick up when you're like 47. You can feel, and we might actually start this at the website. We might actually do some classical programming, because I run into a lot of people who say to me, they feel they understand that they're missing something, but then you say, okay, here's some Brahms, and they don't get what they're missing. It's like it's too late, and I think that's sad, and it's a real loss. I didn't know. I'll tell you about how I know classical music. I did do it at school. I had a nice music teacher. He was undergoing a bit of a personal crisis, so he would be moody and erratic. And I remember he came in and he goes, "Today we're going to do Beethoven." He put the record on the LP player and he goes, "Dun dun dun dun." He goes, "Right, that's enough of that," because he was going through a bit of a midlife crisis. And I could tell the difference between Bach and Mozart and Beethoven. I knew very little of it. I applied for one of my first jobs in radio, and I thought I was going to do a job of, the stuff I often talk about here, pop standards, mainstream pop standards. And when I got there, the guy, in fact, it was a vacancy for a classical show. And I didn't really know anything about classical music. And I'll tell you this as a life tip from me, for what it's worth. I didn't really know about classical music, certainly not enough to host a classical music show, and certainly nowhere near enough to work for the BBC's music station, Radio 3, and their the proms, the promenade concerts in London, which I eventually I did Radio 3 and all the rest of it a few years later. But the reason I said yes to the classical show is because I thought I could learn on the job and that it would be stuff worth learning. So it's not a waste of time if someone says, you know, you're like a guy who's into hip hop and they say, how would you like to do a classical show? Say yes to it. Because the stuff, it'll be stuff that's worth learning. You won't be wasting your time. And I think that's a good tip in life. And that stuff has stayed, the stuff I learned during that classical show has stayed with me. And I like doing that. And I think that's a good way, I think that's a good way to approach life. Is it worth, and I often distinguish about this, between the stuff that's flotsam and jetsam. Is it worth becoming an expert in Trent Lott? Or Tom Daschle? No, because no one's going to remember them. I don't remember them already. But is it worth becoming an expert in Brahms? Yeah, it is actually, kind of. And I think you should always distinguish between that. Is it worth me, if I've got to like get my head down and bone up on this stuff, is it stuff worth boning up on? And that's the way I approach it. Nicola Timmerman writes, after this appalling winter in Ontario, I'm wondering why you decided to move to New Hampshire rather than Florida. Live free and freeze? well, Nicola, it's true. I wound up in New Hampshire because I was on an Amtrak overnight train from Montreal to New York and it broke down halfway. I've told this before. And they threw us off the train. I thought it was nice around here. And so I decided the following morning I'd look for somewhere to live. And if you're from Quebec, you know, I thought New Hampshire was like Florida, and it was, I didn't realize, because in Quebec, you know, the Quebecers just say, oh, we're going to America for the winter, and I thought all of America was warm. It didn't occur to me that there were places that are as cold as Canada in America. I don't know how that happened. It's all a big, you know, basically when they drew the map of North America and they divided it north-south, it was very unfair to Canada. And they should have divided it east-west, so like there would have been some warm bits of Canada then. But the only consolation is that how, no matter how freezing cold Canada is, it's good to know that there are some parts of America that are freezing cold too. So I am happy to be freezing in New Hampshire. Brian Houston says, hi, Bart, where are you planning to be next in the UK so I can plan to attend and hopefully shake your hand and invite you to Northumberland, the real UK. Northumberland is a beautiful part of England, Brian, and you're not going to get any argument from me there. I can't remember the last time I gave a speech in the United Kingdom. Actually, I think I can. I think it was like about 2 weeks before Obama's inauguration. I think I spoke at an event that Douglas Murray organized. I speak everywhere. I go to speak in Canada, speak in America, speak in Australia, speak in Europe, in Denmark and places. But it's been a long time. So we will try to make that happen. Brian, we'll do some event in the United Kingdom. Emily Maximiv writes, Mark, one of my favourite episodes of The Mark Steyn Show was the one in which you interviewed Dr. Jordan Peterson. I've been a fan of his ever since and been following the media backlash over his recent interview with Channel 4's Cathy Newman. The network has turned the story upside down and now report, as we were talking about earlier, that the interviewers received threats of violence from Peterson's supporters. Thus, representing him as the official spokesperson for transphobia, misogyny, sexism. As he demonstrated in the interview, this couldn't be further from the truth. What good can be done when a person is criminalised for simply having a conversation? Yeah, you know, as I said, you don't bother debating people who won't debate you in good faith. And I think that's what Channel 4 did to him. And it's, I'll tell you, I've said it's a long time since I was in Britain. I was actually on the BBC a few years ago, for the first time in a while, on Newsnight with Kirsty Walk. And Kirsty, you know, if you anyone in Britain will know Kirsty, she does the main late night. She's like the Ted Koppel or whoever it is, main late night current affairs show in Britain. And she, you know, her views are no. She's BBC from Scotland, which is the hardcore end of the BBC. You don't have to. It doesn't take a lot of trouble figuring out where she's coming from. But she actually didn't do a gotcha interview, and it was quite a an insightful and useful exchange from both our sides. And in fact, Diane Abbott, who's also on there, who's the paramour of Jeremy Corbyn, former paramour, some years past, but Diane Abbott, who's like hardcore leftist, again, it's the same thing. She was actually on the show, and we talked in the green room beforehand and afterwards and all the rest of it. And again, she's happy to take it face value and have a reasonable exchange with you. That's not what Kathy Newman wanted to do. Kathy Newman wanted to set up Jordan Peterson. And unfortunately, she wasn't good enough to do it. If you're going to play gotcha with somebody, if you're going to screw someone over, you got to be good at it. And she wasn't any good at it. That's basically the point. And he didn't have to do anything clever. He didn't have to be mean to the poor. I like the way this, Channel 4, we got like the strong female interviewers. But if you push back against them, you're just a big mean bully beating up the little girl. Jordan Peterson, he took the most insulting questions and he responded calmly in a clear, quiet, cool-headed, civilized manner. And so because the interview didn't accomplish what it was meant to for Kathy Newman, Channel 4 decided to kill him in the post-interview by branding all his supporters as lunatics who just want to kill you. And this is actually the opposite of what's going on at the moment. If you look at the violence that's being perpetrated in most of the Western world, it's actually leftist violence. You know, for the most part, I mean, yes, there are people who like saying idiotic things on Twitter, but for the most part, one of the reasons the right likes to debate, one of the reasons Jordan Peterson likes to be interviewed, is because if you're on the right, you don't actually get asked to go and debate terribly often, because they don't want you to debate. And so, generally speaking, on the right, Jordan Peterson or me, a lot of us are happy to go and debate these people and appear on these shows and all the rest of it, as I was happy to do in Toronto with Simon Sharma and Louise Arbour. But because they're not invited on the CBC and the BBC and all the rest of it, actually people on the right value debate simply because they get so little chance to have a genuine debate. Whereas on the left, because basically they say there shouldn't be a debate, the great questions of our time have been decided. The great questions about climate change, about immigration, about gay marriage, about transgender bathrooms, all the great questions have been settled. There is nothing to debate. There is just the correct attitude, and so there's nothing to debate. Have actually got really bad at debating. That's Kathy Newman's problem. And you hear it all the time on Channel 4 particularly, which I'm astonished, actually. I'm astonished how bad Channel 4 News has gotten. Jon Snow, the guy I last watched Channel 4 News, I don't know when it was, 1980, whatever. But Jon Snow was doing it then. Jon Snow is doing it now as a sort of cranky old geezer with eccentric ties and wacky socks. But what's interesting to me is the assumptions behind the questions, the groupthink, the indestructible worldview, ever narrowing, ever shrinking. So when somebody from outside that world comes on, like Jordan Peterson, all you can do is condescend to him and assume that everyone agrees with you that he's a complete idiot. And he's a laughingstock, and he's a joke, as the Channel 4 press office thought. And then he kicks your butt all across the studio floor, and all you can do is then complain that people are being mean to you on social media. It's not going to work, this. It's not going to work. And these people really need to rethink it. Because if you want to protect liberal values or progressive values, then actually demonstrating that you're a bonehead who can't actually defend those values, who can't actually defend the progressive point of view, who actually crumbles is instantly, that's actually quite a big problem for you. Thank you for that question, Emily. I'll tell you what, we'll have one more thing. Let me recommend as a tale for our time one of the first stories, says George Pereira, that had alien abductions, electric spaceships, spacesuits, aliens building the pyramids, space battles, oxygen pills, asteroid mining, disintegration rays, 40-foot space women from another planet. Oh, I would love a 40-foot space woman from another planet. There are none in New Hampshire. I've been to Vermont. I can't find a foot. I go to Vermont. I think I'd like to just walk into a bar, have a drink with a 40-foot space woman from another planet. There are never any around when you want them. Not in Barrie, Vermont, anyway. Maybe I should try Rutland. This book is from 1898, Garrett P. Service and his epic Edison's Conquest of Mars. I will take that and we will note it and we will pass it up to the committee. We've got a deputy assistant president of programming who is to pass it to the senior assistant vice president of programming, and the senior assistant vice president of programming will get it to the executive senior, even more senior vice president of programming, and we'll get back to you on that, George. Thank you for all your questions. This has been a Clubland Q&A live around the planet. All questions from members of the Mark Stein Club. If you're not in the club, you can always join the club. You can join the club either for the full year or See if you got a taste for it. If people are in it a bit creepy, you don't want to be weirded out by them. Try it just for a quarter. That's 3 months in metric. And see how much you enjoy it. And if you'd like to sign up for the full year, you go to steinonline.com. And there's like a little Mark Stein Club thing on the menu bar. And we will be delighted to have you join our number. But you got to do all the paperwork first. We don't have any undocumented members of the Mark Stein Club. There are no dreamers in the Mark Stein Club. We enforce our borders. Thanks a lot for being with us. We'll see you next time.